Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This episode of Ramble Meets is sponsored by Bet365.
Sam Matterface, formerly football commentator, now known for sequins and cheesy lines on Dancing on Ice.
Sam, it's an absolute pleasure to be sat here with you. I've been looking forward to talking to you for a little while. I think the art of football commentary is a fascinating one. But first of all, I would like to start by asking you your story, how you became a commentator on national radio and national TV.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me.
Pleasure.
As a geek, as someone who loves to look at how podcasts are put together and radio is put together, it's great to come in here and have a look at how you've set the place up. And the tour that you gave me earlier was very kind, by the way.
Welcome.
It's not our first time in the studio together because we've worked together at TalkSport before.
We have.
But it's good to come and see you in your own habitat.
Natural environment. Yeah. See how the sausage is made. The tour was very short because the premises are very small, but it was a tour nonetheless.
Yeah, it took at least about 3.5 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
I started, I think, probably 1992, I think it was. November 1992. Mm-hmm. I was 14 and a half.
Right.
And hospital radio got me started. I was a bit of a saddo as a kid, really. I wanted to play football, but I was average at best. But I was a tryer. I was one of those who...
Oh, you're fitting around there, mate.
I was one of those who sort of hung around trying to get onto the school team. In fact, I remember I was always named as a sub or a reserve for the school teams, but I almost always got into the team.
Right.
Because I just kept going. And it didn't matter that I wasn't perceived as good enough to be in that squad.
Yeah,
I would just keep going until I got into it. And then I got into it. And once I was in it, it was difficult to get me out because I was a bit of a... I'm a grafter.
Yeah.
I believe that, you know, talent is great. I'm sure loads of people have got talent and there is such a thing as raw talent, but I don't have any. Hmm. So all I can do is graft my way. And that's what I did with the football. And I think I've done that sort of with the commentary as well. I think you just keep working and hoping that people keep giving you gigs. I started with hospital radio. I went to Portsmouth when I was about 21 and took a gamble on life. I worked in a McDonald's to fund my radio habit.
Yeah.
Over the course of six
Your
or
radio
seven
addiction.
Years. Yeah. Well, the McDonald's was great because it was a Saturday job that wasn't necessarily one that occupied you for the whole of Saturday. Mm. So I could still do football and I could still do radio. So I could work Friday nights, Saturday mornings, or Saturday nights, or Sunday mornings. And
so at hospital radio, you were volunteering, right?
Is that
right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's all voluntary. And then you moved to Portsmouth to take up a job at 107.4 The Key. But where are you from originally?
From southeast London. I was born in Dartford. I lived in Orpington and Bromley.
Okay, so you moved away from your hometown to go and take up on a bit of a punt to go to Portsmouth and commentate on Portsmouth games. Is that right?
Oh, I had a really successful McDonald's career in which I ended up being a restaurant manager of a McDonald's at the age of 20. I was the youngest one in the country, you know.
Wow, that's to be fair, that is very good. I mean, you shouldn't sneer at that kind of stuff.
No, I think it was a great grounding for me. But I left because I just thought, I don't want to do this. I want to do radio. And I didn't have a job, so I worked in a Virgin Megastore.
Did you practice your radio on the drive-through intercom at McDonald's?
I only ever worked in one drive. Actually, no, I worked in two drive-throughs. No, but I never did any of that stuff. I was managing.
Because there was a guy who was, I don't think it's called that anymore, but Choice FM in London, there was a guy who was a DJ there, and he got found, he got discovered by using the intercom system on the London bus he was driving.
Really?
And he would entertain the passengers by going, and now we're stopping here, now we're stopping there, look at this, look at that. And that's how he got picked up.
There's a few people on the Rail network that do that, I think, showcase their talent. There's a guy who does a Manchester to London train. He always does a quiz.
Does he really?
Yeah, it's great.
So there's ways to do it. There's ways to do it.
There's definitely ways.
So sorry, go back to you. So you're at McDonald's, you left McDonald's, and then you went to the Key.
Well, no, I worked as a volunteer for BBC Radio Kent, Wimbledon Football Club for a long time. And then Capital Gold, I did some freelance work for. I was begging people to give me a job doing radio, and I wasn't getting paid for it, but I was just making myself available so I could learn how to do it properly and with professional intent. I sent off a CV to every single radio station in the country, including BBC local radio stations and commercial radio stations. And eventually, just out of the blue, someone had found a CV, and they were so desperate to get someone who knew something about football, because they were starting a new radio station and they hadn't got a clue about football.
Right.
That they rang me, said, could you come and have a chat with us? And I said, yeah.
Yeah.
Although I am just about to sign a contract with, and I just made up that I was signing a contract with Capital. They said, don't do anything until you come and see us. So I thought of put them in a, they were in a desperate position anyway, and I just put them in a more desperate position. And then they gave me the job as a sports editor on a radio station, and I had complete freedom to play with that radio station.
Did you know what you were doing? Sort of.
I was sad enough, and I'd been working in the voluntary sector in the hospital radio, which was a big hospital radio station, and other places for long enough. I'd done some commercial radio for Radio Thamesmead as well, to have an idea of what I was doing, So
it must have been quite daunting, though.
No. I was 22, 23, so I was, you know, young, cocky.
Right, okay.
Thought, yeah, I can do this.
Okay.
And bluffed my way through it. Yeah. And then it worked. We got lucky. And Portsmouth had a fantastic journey at that point. I joined as Graham Ricks was coming to the end of his tenure. Harry Redknapp took over the year after I first joined. And I got to follow all of that. And then their wonderful rise. I mean, it was amazing time to be down there.
Yeah, I mean, I was living down there at the time. And without making this a Portsmouth loving, because I know you're not a Portsmouth fan, although you do have an affinity with the club, as all great football men do. Yeah, all football people have got great affinity with a historic and illustrious club like Portsmouth. But I remember listening to 107.4 The Key for every Portsmouth game. So not only sports, you weren't only a sports editor, you were also the commentator for the live games, right? Yeah. You were the voice of that promotion season, really, down in Portsmouth. And that must have been an incredible thing, because for a team to get to the Premier League is big anyway, but that city is kind of dominated by the football club, isn't it? And
oh, yeah.
To be the voice of that would have been a pretty cool thing.
Well, you think that Portsmouth hadn't been promoted to the top division since the back end of the 80s. And when I first arrived, all they ever talked about was Radio Victory and Mike Neeson of the News, who was the historic reporter who had just retired at the time.
Yeah.
And these figures played big parts in telling those great stories. And it's a great club. It's a working class, proper city with real enthusiasm for their game and their football club. And they've had a terrible time over the last 10 years, really, since the rise. But at that period, it was on the way up, and I was so lucky to be a part of it. And yeah, do you know what? It was heady days. It was great for me. I enjoyed it. And I ended up not only being the voice of the football, I ended up being the voice of the entire radio station, because it was so small. We had so little money that I ended up having to do breakfast shows and being the programme controller, ultimately, before I left. And
so you just took a room in Portsmouth and rented and
I took a room in an old guy's house. His name was Don, and he was very odd. But he was also very kind. And it was odd to me because he was in his 60s and I was 22. So, you know, yeah. I stayed there for a while. Then I stayed in a hotel. Then I rented a flat. Eventually, when I could afford to pay my own rent, I rented a flat in Southsea.
Yeah.
Right down the seafront. It was a one-bedroom little flat with damp in the corner. And
nice spot, though.
It was a nice spot. Great for walking up and down Osborne Road.
Yeah.
Where all the now over-30s clubs are.
Yeah.
I was in there last
Still
week.
See you walking up and down there now, I expect. Yeah.
It was great. And I just sort of forged a life there. I didn't have any friends. I didn't know one person in Portsmouth when I first moved there.
Hmm. Do you know any now?
I'm now... regularly go back because all my friends are
great.
Well, most of my, not all of my friends, but most of my friends are there or came from there.
But that tells its own story, doesn't it?
A lot of people say that they made their life at university. Well, I went to university for 6 weeks.
Right.
And I just thought it was the most boring experience ever. So I left.
Yeah.
That was nothing to do with the fact that it was in Liverpool. It was more to do with the fact that I'd taken a year out, done lots of work, earned really decent money. Someone offered me a job where I could continue to earn decent money, and I thought 1 hour a day, why?
Surely there must
be another way of doing this, which and probably in hindsight wasn't a great thing to do. Kids stay at university, but
yeah, stay in education, exactly. But this would have been, I'm just aware of the idea that the vast majority of people listening to this are going to know you as a commentator,
yeah.
And this trip down to Portsmouth and this stay in Portsmouth was where you presumably got your first taste of doing live football commentary.
No, I'd done it a lot beforehand for free, and I'd done it a lot for Wimbledon Football Club. The first game I did, I think, was a Wimbledon versus Gillingham game. It finished 4-4, and I thought, this is for me, I've got this bug.
Yeah.
And it was for television. It was a Wimbledon, their in-house television thing, and I got in massive trouble because I compared Peter Hawkins, who was the right back at the time, to the guy out of Seinfeld, because he had this massive, great, big mop of hair. And Alan Kimball was the captain of Wimbledon at the time, and he was absolutely furious when they watched the video back on the Monday morning that I'd insulted one of his teammates. And
that's surprising, because you'd have thought, like, a football player would have thought of that as, in quotes, banter.
Yeah.
You know, good football banter. But the thing is, if you're not part of the football
players...
If you're not part of the elite, exactly. We've all seen Jake Humphrey on BT Sport.
Well, one of the things is that sometimes you really do get into that. And one of the great things about Portsmouth is that I didn't become part of the team. I wasn't part of the team. But I was in their little... Not group. I'd never go as far as to say I infiltrated that dressing room. I didn't, but I was a part of it. I was around it a lot. I spent my days with Eddie Howe, with Richard Hughes, with Steve Stone, with Svetislav Todorov, Paul Merson, Teddy Sheringham.
Yeah.
You know, all these players that came through the door there.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like it is now. There wasn't press conferences. There certainly weren't press officers. Sam used to walk in, sit on the bank, watch, chat. Looking like
so you had free reign, basically.
I just did what I wanted, whenever I wanted. If I wanted to go up on a Monday, I'd just turn up on a Monday.
Right,
go and have a chat. I'd go and sit on the... If it's sunny outside, I'd just go and sit at Southampton University, where they train, down in Eastleigh.
Yeah.
And I'd just hang out, have
and
a cup of coffee.
They wouldn't stop you?
No, never.
And, okay.
Sometimes they'd take me into the dressing room, beat me up.
Yes, fair enough. Fair enough.
Big Kev the Kit Man, you remember him?
He's still there, mate.
He's still there,
He's still there.
He once chased me around the dressing room, got me on the floor and twisted what was an already massive nose till it went purple.
And you're saying, imagine what they would have done if they didn't like you. You said you're part of their group.
And I was supposed to be his mate.
Kev's quite terrible. I mean, very, very friendly man, but quite terrifying.
Well, he was an ex-Commonwealth boxer.
Yeah,
so
quite.
He went to the Commonwealth Games for Wales as a heavyweight boxer. He's massive. But he's also a very funny man.
You said earlier that you said
touchy feely
when you, to say the least, when you commentated, you thought, this is a bit of me. I like this.
Yeah.
Were you aware early on that you could actually do it? Or was it difficult to start with?
No, it's never been. Well, look, I'm not saying I'm great at it. I can do it. I think. I think that I've always been able to do it. I think it is one of those things you can do or you can't.
Mm.
And I think there's a guy at TalkSport I spoke to who used to be the head of Live Sport, now runs TalkSport too, Mike Beauville, who always said to me, it is a skill, isn't it, that you can do or you can't? I said, and I agree with him. And we have had a conversation about commentators and how we can do things. And I do believe it is one of those things that you either get straight away or you'll never get, because there's so much to it. You always have to have a blank mind when you're doing it, because you can't you can't let anybody interfere with your thought of what you can see in front of you, especially when you're first starting. As time goes on, you can adapt to that because you have a lot of voices in your ear. You have, especially on television, you have a lot of things that you know that you need to get in to curate the story.
But
you've got to be able to call the action. That's the main thing. And be able to see who's got the ball and where that ball is and communicate that. And I think that is something that, you know, even now, sometimes you listen to the radio and we're not as good as sometimes we need to be in terms of geography.
Mm.
And where is the ball? That is the key thing, especially on the radio. I mean, on the television, it's completely different. It's a different skill.
Who were the best commentators for you when you were growing up? Because here at the Ramble, we've always loved Barry Davis. He'd be our favourite.
We have to say he's magnificent.
Exactly. But there was a big schism, wasn't there, between people who loved Barry Davis and people who loved John Watson. But I don't think there needs to be, of course.
I was Barry when I was younger. I was very much Barry. And Barry did the only FA Cup final. The only FA Cup final he did was the FA Cup final that my club got to in 1994 and lost 4-0. And Glenn Hoddle came, it's 4-0, took his zip down the front of his jacket as if said, "I'm going to come and save the day now." Glenn, sit down. It's 4-0.
It's done, it's done.
It's over, mate. Yeah. There's no Superman act coming here.
But when you listen to Barry Davis, I'm trying to get a feeling of were you inspired by that? Did you always plan to do this kind of thing?
Jonathan Pearce, I think, was the one that inspired me the most on Capital Gold Sport, because that's what I grew up listening to on a Saturday afternoon. Mm. And Five Live, Mike Ingham, big fan of Mike Ingham, but that was as I was getting older. So I started, I think, with Jonathan Pearce. Alan Green and Mike Ingham were heroes of mine after that. From Five Live, those two very much sort of played a part in my development as a commentator. Mm. Mike, I've got to know latterly. You know, I think he's just great. I mean, I know he's retired now, but he was great. I think, and then over time, I've sort of spent time with other commentators. Martin Tyler has been good to me. Ian Dark was absolutely magnificent to me early on.
Another Pompey lad.
Yeah, he listened to my tapes when I was at Portsmouth.
Right.
And I think the first person who ever said to me that I should be doing commentary was my granddad. We were sitting watching a charity shield back in the day when it was a charity shield. And I did it for my mates. I was just messing around. And he said, you've got to say that's good.
Yeah.
To one of my mates. And I thought, oh, interesting.
Yeah.
And that was always in my mind.
Yeah.
And then I think when I sent a couple of tapes to Ian, and Darky listened to all of it and then wrote me a letter afterwards saying, you should be doing this at a national radio level, not just local level.
Right.
Gave me the inspiration to then try and kick on again, because I had a very comfortable existence in Portsmouth. I had really enjoyed it in terms of, you know, I wasn't rich or anything.
Not many people can say that, you know.
No, but I loved my life there. It was a fantastic, I loved it. It was the people I worked with. I was so lucky. I worked with some brilliant people. Jenny Gow, I hired her from BBC Radio Solent. She's now the Formula One presenter for Five Live. Mm. Jonathan Becker, I hired him from a radio station in Guildford, and he works on Sky doing the Match Choice games as a commentator now. Dan Windles on TalkSport 2 worked with us. Alex Crook worked with us down there. Loads of people. Rich Hurst does a show down in Worcester, where was the breakfast show, so local celebrity. I go to Worcester to see him. You can't go anywhere without him having a selfie with about 17 girls. Loads of great, talented people were in that radio station at the same time. Lots of young people. And I think it came out of a local college. A lot of it came out of the local college, Highbury College,
Of course,
which had a great journalism post.
It's got a good reputation for that.
It's fantastic.
The NCTG down there.
We had a lot of talented people there. So I was lucky to have that environment. And I didn't necessarily want to leave.
Hmm.
But I got a few pushes to do that, and then eventually I did.
But also, I mean, I feel like when you work in the media, for me at least, you need some time to learn it on the job, right? Because you can't replicate it.
Oh, absolutely.
If I sat and did stuff that was never going to be put out there, it would never be. It's almost like trying to replicate a penalty shootout in a competition. You can't replicate the tension, the tense drama, all the pressure. And so I guess without being disrespectful to my hometown, and why would I do that?
Yeah.
You get a chance to make your mistakes.
Absolutely.
When we first doing the Ramble, it was fine because no one listened, right? So for the first year or two, you could really just make all your mistakes and no one would care.
Oh, we've done some crazy stuff. I mean, I did some really ridiculous stuff that involved... It actually got me in a lot of trouble. I got in a lot of trouble a few times. I got Ofcom complaints coming out of my ear.
Right.
Because I thought, the only way to make that radio station, it was a new radio station, the only way to make it known about was to cause a stir.
Yeah.
So we did.
Of course. All right, listen, let's go for a little break. And when we come back, we'll talk about Sam's transition from local roustabout in Portsmouth to national commentator invading the consciousness of football fans all over the country. Don't go anywhere.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
All right, welcome back to Ramble Meets with me, Luke, and I am joined by Sam Matterface, as you know, because you've already heard the first half. Sam, after the key, you went to Sky Sports, is that right?
Correct.
And you worked on Sky Sports News.
So I decided to chuck it all in at Portsmouth at the end of a season in which, and you will remember this, they played Arsenal on the final day of a season, I think it was the end of 2007, mm-hmm. and they should have had a penalty, which if they'd scored it, would have taken them into Europe above Blackburn Rovers because of either, it was either fair play or something like mm-hmm. that. They mm-hmm. would have got into Europe that season. It didn't happen. Mm. Graham Pohl was the referee. And they messed it up. They missed the decision up. They didn't get a penalty. And Portsmouth finished in eighth, I think. Mm. And I thought it's not going to get better than this. I'm off.
It was the second worst decision in Portsmouth's Premier League history. The first being when Robert Pires dived over Arian Dazou in a game.
Arian Dazou dived over.
And Portsmouth would have broken Arsenal's invincible record.
Yes. Yes.
So it still sticks in my craw now. But anyway, sorry, carry on.
Teddy did score that game though, didn't they? They did score at Highbury that day.
I think so, yeah.
Teddy scored, I believe.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, where were we? We were talking about. I said I can't do it anymore. I fell out with the people that were working above me, and I just thought I've had enough. And I was getting ratty.
Yeah.
So Power FM, another big radio station on the South Coast, asked me to be their breakfast show host and take over from a guy who'd been working there for years, mm-hmm. Rick Jackson. I was putting football to one side for a bit, and I was just going to go and do a breakfast show there. Mm-hmm. And I just signed up with an agent. Some guy had come and said to me, can you come and, you know, why don't we represent you? And I was like, whatever. Hmm. And he said, I was going to have an Arctic Monkeys concert. And he rang me up and he said to me, on your way to Cardiff, don't know why I was going to Cardiff to watch the Arctic Monkeys, but I was, could you just pop into Sky? They're looking for presenters. They've got a few departures and they would like to just see, you know, whether or not you can do it. I was like, why? And he goes, basically, he'd touted out that he'd got two or three people on his books that could do this job and, mm-hmm. you know, he'd pushed me into it. Mm-hmm. And honestly, Luke, I didn't think anything of it. I walked in, I met a guy called Ian Brash, who's a very good director. And he said, I'd never done television before. I'd never even seen it. I mean, I've done television commentary once for Wimbledon, as I mentioned,
Not the same thing, is it?
No, well, presenting television, no.
Yeah.
But I walked in, they sat me in a studio, they said, can you read the auto cue? I went, all right then. Mm. And I read it. Now, a bit like you said, it commentary, it is just reading out loud.
Yeah.
And it is a skill. You know, reading a script is a skill. I've been lucky. I think radio is a fantastic grounding for any sort of broadcasting. And I still believe that now. And I think if you listen to anyone, I think, who's done radio, will tell you that their best thing that they have learned, the skills that they've learned in radio, they've been able to transfer into TV. I don't think it's always the same the other way around. If you've gone TV first and into radio, I don't think that's as easy. Mm. But I just did it. And then I did it and then I went home. And just before I walked out the door, I said, is that it? And the guy said to me, yeah. I said, all right, see you soon. He went, oh, yeah, we'll see you soon. I didn't think anything of it.
Right.
I went to the Arctic Monkeys, got absolutely wasted, really enjoyed myself, got back to Portsmouth the next afternoon, and I got a phone call saying they'd offer me a contract.
Cool.
So I moved.
And you went to Sky Sports News and you did some stuff with Jim White and did breaking news stuff and all that sort of exciting
thing. We did the first Dread Deadline Day and then I got ditched.
Oh, really? Why do you think that was?
I don't think I'm as funny or as cool as he is. No. Or as many contacts in my mobile phone as his.
Well, no one's got as many contacts in their mobile phone.
Unbelievable.
As Jim White. But I'd, if it's okay with you, I'd like to fast forward through to your TalkSport stuff, because you've been there for a number of years now. And like I say, people do know you as a commentator. And what does a good commentator need to have? What makes a good commentator?
Accuracy. Mm. You've got to be able to believe what they're saying. Mm. So you've got to genuinely depict what you see. Mm. Are we talking about radio or TV?
Radio.
For radio, you genuinely have to give them a real true reflection of what's happening in the game. You can't describe every single touch. It's impossible to do that. The game is at such a speed. But you've got to give people a flavour of what is happening. And that is not always the action on the pitch. Because sometimes, as you know, going to football, there are games where nothing happens on the pitch. So then you sort of lurch into conversations that people are having about what's happening on the pitch, or, you know, what's happening in the stands, or what the feeling is amongst a set of supporters, or a narrative compared to comparable to the story that is developing in front of you, whatever that may be. It might be some big issue or whatever. But I think you've just got to be reliable. People have got to believe what you're telling them.
And how important is the relationship with the co-commentator, particularly on radio? You know where I'm going with this.
Very good. You have to trust each other, and it has to be very good. Yeah.
Because when I used to listen to you a lot when TalkSport. I don't know if they still do, but TalkSport used to have exclusive Saturday evening games, and you used to do that.
I still do it. Yeah, it's 9 years now.
You used to do it with Stan Collymore.
I used to do Saturdays and Sundays, and sometimes every Tuesday and Wednesday with Stan. Yeah.
In my opinion, you and Stan were very good together.
Yeah, I think it divided opinion.
I thought you were very good.
Some people really liked it.
I really liked it, yeah.
Some people, I think, didn't like it towards the end.
Were you one of those people?
No, he's the longest relationship I've ever had.
Yeah, professionally?
Both. We sat in the back of a cab actually once in Sunderland, and I knew it was coming to an end. I don't know why, I just had a feeling. And we were driving to the game, it was like literally the last game of the season, I think. And we sat down and the geezer started talking about how long we've been working together. And I said exactly what I just said to you. I haven't had a girlfriend as long as I've been with Stan. But yeah, I spoke to him the other week actually. And he's had a tough time recently.
Yeah.
But he is, he has got talent in terms of broadcasting.
Was there any moment I'll talk a little bit about the preparation that's needed and all that kind of stuff in a minute, but because you've done Champions League finals, you've done the World Cup, you've done lots of different bits and pieces. Was there any moment where you thought, yeah, I've made it now? This is brilliant.
No. I panic every day.
Do you?
That it's going to come to an end.
Right.
Oh, yeah. What would you do if it had stopped tomorrow? What would you do if you'd done this great, you've built this great studio, this great podcast empire. What would you do if it stopped tomorrow?
Yeah, it's difficult to say, really.
Well, you don't know, do you? Because you don't think about that, because you're so into what you're doing at the moment. You don't think, but when you
probably
sometimes
avoid
do,
my wife for a little bit.
You sometimes do sit and think about what you'd do after it all comes crashing down.
But surely your whole career can't be underpinned by the insecurity of losing your job. Presumably you've got to enjoy the work,
absolutely,
otherwise you won't.
Absolutely underpins everything you do. Because I think it drives me. I never think I've done a good job. I'm the worst critic in the world at what I do. I will listen back to a lot of what I produce and go, you shouldn't have said that. I don't like how that sounded. In the future, I want to change that. Why didn't we talk about this? I listened to a game back the other day. I did a Chelsea-Manchester United in the first half. I came at the end of it, the first half. I thought, brilliant, fantastic. I thought that worked really well. Listened to the second half and thought it was dreadful.
Right. Okay, so you're continually monitoring your own improvements.
Yeah.
Because I think it's quite a common thing for broadcasters to listen back to stuff they've done a while ago and be like, I can't listen to that, it's too cringe. Because you're always moving on and learning new things.
I mean, if you ever hear me do the Aguero moment,
yeah.
I mean, it's the worst thing I've ever heard in my life.
And what it's particularly in comparison to Martin Tyler's?
Just crap.
Right, okay.
It's total and utter nonsense.
Right. Why do you think that is? Because you're just in the
moment. Stan was shouting. And I was trying to shout over him,
right?
And he's louder than I am,
yeah.
And it just sounds, and it was bedlam. I mean, the difference is, and this is another thing that I think people don't understand, is that TV commentators are usually insulated a little bit from the crowd in the fact that they are somewhere miles away. So they might be on a gantry which is purposely built. They're higher up,
sure.
Or they're out the way, or they're at the back.
Whereas you're just in the press box, right?
In the press box. So yeah. The radio commentators are literally in the crowd. So we're
you can sometimes hear other language commentary in the background when you're listening to a major tournament's radio commentary, for example.
Absolutely, and sometimes you just hear lots of other industrial language.
Yeah,
And that was the case at this moment when that goal went in. It just erupted all around us, and it was mad. It was absolutely mad. The whole stand almost felt like it was going to fall in on top of me. And I couldn't see anymore. And Stan was standing up and he was screaming. And I was screaming. It just sounds awful. And I just hate listening to it. And Richard Keys said to me afterwards, because he was working with us at the time and we'd done a few games together. And he said to me, when I came in on the Monday morning, I walked in. He said, what did you think of your commentary at the weekend for the Aguero thing? I said, I thought it was awful. He went, correct.
Turn it in, Keys.
It was right, though.
Turn it in,
no,
Keys.
No, but he was right. And actually, it informed me, because about 2 weeks later, maybe longer than that, I went to Munich to do the Champions League final for Chelsea. And I made sure that, even though I'm a Chelsea supporter, that I couldn't lose my cool. I had to make sure that I got it right, the moment's right.
Quite an interesting situation for you in that, because you probably wanted more than anything else to be a part of it and to get involved, maybe be there with your pals or whatever.
I did get involved afterwards, that's for sure.
I bet you did. But it's a great privilege anyway to do the job, so I suppose you've got to use
that to pin. Absolutely.
So you're your own worst critic then. What do you make of everyone out there who has an opinion of your commentary and your job, which, as we've established, is a very difficult one to get right? I mean, is it because we're far less insulated to criticism these days, aren't we, because of social media or the rest of it? What's your strategy for approaching that? Because I've done one of these with Jim White, and he's basically, I mean, he's obviously a bit older, and he's like, I don't care. You don't either? Okay.
I can't care. I did care at the beginning,
because some people do get involved, some people do engage, some
really,
people try and explain themselves.
Really shook me at the beginning,
yeah,
because I didn't understand it. Social media was new when I first started doing TalkSport. Social media was new, but you know, television, believe me, when you get onto it, well, I'm doing ITV, a World Cup, 12 million people watching the game. Some people do have an opinion,
yeah, right, exactly, yeah.
And they ain't gonna like some of it, and they are gonna like it. And you know, we broadcast slightly different on ITV because we have 12 million, sometimes 20 million people watching a game, and not all of those people are clear football fans and are really into the minutiae of football tactics. We have to be quite broad brush in the way we explain things, because your nan might watch it, or my mum watches it, or you know, my uncle who doesn't know anything about football might just turn on for that particular
game.
It's
kind of like the Match of the Day thing, isn't it, where people will get really heads up about Match of the Day is really dumbing down and all this other stuff. And I think they've actually recently done a really good job of covering that thing you're talking about. People fail to understand that if you're I watch seven games a week football fan, it's not for you.
No.
It's a highlights program for people who didn't watch the games today because they didn't pay for Sky or they've got other interests. And so it's just a way for them to enjoy the highlights and a little bit of analysis in a 2 minute
Absolutely.
Section.
Right? And you have to, you can't always, not everyone understands that because they're not in the media industry, but we have to sort of rise above that a little bit.
Yeah.
So we'll take a little bit of that criticism, because our main objective is to serve the majority of the people rather than.
So you don't let it affect you?
Oh, I can't now. No, I don't even look at it anymore. After a game, I don't even bother.
No.
It's pointless. I'll know if I've done a good job or a bad job. And my boss will tell me if I've done a good job. Yeah. I've got great producers. I'm really lucky. I work with some wonderful people. At ITV, I mean, I've got one of the best producers that I think has ever walked the earth. He used to be the head of ITV Sport, and he's followed me around for the last two tournaments. So, you know, Tony Pastor, who's now an independent producer, works with Gary Lineker on all his independent stuff, and he comes with me to do all the games, and he is just fantastic.
Such a safe pair of hands then.
Yeah, and he'll tell me if it's wrong.
And so when you transition from radio to TV, my personal taste, I don't like a TV commentator talking too much. I think I understand the inspiration you got from Jonathan Pearce, but for me, someone like, I don't expect you to name and shame, so I'll do it on your behalf. Darren Fletcher talks way too much. It feels like he's having a conversation with his co-commentator over the top of TV
pitches. That's the style. They've decided on that as a house style.
How would you describe your style? On TV, I mean.
I don't know. I don't think I talk as much as they do on BT, but I don't think I'm Barry Davis or John Champion. I mean, John and I have had a conversation about it. John once went, I think, about 3 minutes without saying a word during a live game.
Yeah.
And he's very good at that. He allows that to happen.
Well, Davis would say, I just want to punctuate the pitches, right? Yeah. That's it, yeah.
I just think it's changed. I think the style has changed, and the way we do football commentary will continue to evolve, and I think we'll have more talking rather than less. Especially when, as you now put in three voices, which I think is probably going to become the norm.
Yeah. Yeah, that has been a sort of more recent addition, hasn't it? BT Sport have been in the vanguard of that, really, haven't they?
Yep.
You don't like it?
I do like it. Yeah, I think it's the right thing to do.
It's less work for you to do.
It's harder.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's hard, especially on radio. But it's, I think it's the right thing to do. I think they've done some great stuff. And I actually think Darren's very, very good. I think he is one of the best.
Talk to me about the preparation that's required for a game.
Oh, I don't ever stop. Right. Every day. Right. Before I came here, I was in a cafe around the corner. Very nice one, by the way.
Yeah.
And I was just getting ready for tonight's game, tomorrow's game, the weekend. I've got two games at the weekend.
What does the preparation actually consist of, though?
Reading, listening, watching, writing.
Will you try and go for, say, three facts about a player? So you've got it there if you need it.
I've got no objective in that.
Right, okay.
I have a structure that I work to. Clive helped me sort of formulate a plan of how I do things over time, because he liked to have the idea of a clear narrative. So you have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and you set a match up at the beginning, and at the end of the match you give its context.
Yeah.
which makes a lot of sense. And the way I write for a game is very much around that.
So maybe, for example, and this will be a terrible example because I'm not a commentator, say England are playing a team that they haven't beaten for 15 years, you'd maybe start with that sort of narrative. And at the end, if they did win, you'd go, and the hoodoo is broken. Or if it didn't win, you'd say, and it continues.
I think that's the idea. If there's a clear story, if there's not a clear story, also,
what do you do when it's like Wigan against Brentford in the
there'll always be a story,
right?
But I think the other thing is that you can't be dictated to by what you thought was going to happen before the game. You have to be able to react to what has happened in it and then sum it up and give the context if it has changed during that course of the 90 minutes and reflect what's happened. So it's all right having these great ideas. I mean, sometimes I did a game the other night. Here's a prime example. I did probably 8 hours research for Portugal versus Ukraine. We did the game. It was 0-0. It was absolutely terrible. It was guff, as it always is when you watch Portugal, because they are bloody boring.
Yeah.
An awful football team, despite the great... that's probably a bit too strong. They're not an awful football team. They're just a very dull team to watch. And they lack... Despite the fact that they've got Ronaldo, even Diego Souza came off the bench, Bernardo Silva, all these great players, score any goals.
No,
it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's 0-0. So we finished the highlights package.
And I walked out, is this TV already?
Yes, it's TV.
TV, okay.
I walked out of the studio and the producer said to me, that's crap. I said, we've picked one game to do highlights on to go with our England coverage, and we've picked this one. I said, well, pick another one. Just change it now. That was at half time, actually. So at half time, they re-edited the France Moldova match. So I did 90 minute commentary on Portugal versus Ukraine. At full time, it came out. It was guff. They gave me a 4 minute edit, and instead, I just revoiced that just off the cuff.
What, you commentated on the 4 minutes you saw as you saw it?
Yeah.
And they just used that?
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
Because that game was crap. So,
So you've got to be versatile.
Nowadays you have to be nimble.
Yeah.
But I think you can do all the research you want in the world, but ultimately, you know, sometimes you do use it, sometimes you don't use it.
I asked you briefly earlier about this relationship with your co-commentator, but in the context of preparation, do you expect to get a good grip of your co-commentator beforehand and find out what research they've done, or do you just want them just to add a bit of colour?
I don't like co-commentators that do too much research and stray into my territory in terms of statistical analysis. I think I was probably more like that when I was working with Danny Higginbottom a lot. And Danny would sometimes go into my territory and I'd be thinking, what? And then I actually thought, I stepped back and looked at it and think, actually, this is quite good.
Right.
Because what he did was he would be putting those things into a sort of significance. I think he's one of the best, Danny. I think he's really good at, I mean, his tactical stuff is fantastic. I was a bit more sort of, but he was great at ringing you up and chatting with you and what are you going to start with? How are you going to get into it? He was brilliant. He's very good at forming those relationships with people. He's good at that.
Right.
And I think a lot of people could learn from him, really.
Right.
But, you know, Stan and I never spoke before. We'd get to a game. We'd talk about loads of other bits and pieces and just go with it. Because Stan's very impulsive and just wants to be there. I did some stuff with Gary Neville. Again, we would talk briefly before a game, but nothing major. Some people were like, "Nah, don't just hit me with it, and I'll react to it."
Right.
But yeah, it depends who it is. Really, different people. Like everything, it's different people, isn't it? You know.
Absolutely.
Some people want to be ultra prepared. Some people have their own routine. Some people want to bounce ideas off you beforehand.
Where do you think it's going then? So you talked about three commentators now, which is a quite new thing. What do you think the future of all this stuff is? I mean, there's going to be presumably a need for a lot more commentators if we're going to show a lot more football. It appears to be going that way. We were talking earlier, weren't we, before we came on about the development of football broadcasting and how many more games we may see broadcast. What do you think is going to happen? Do you think it's going to be a whole new generation coming through?
I don't know. I don't know how hard that is going to be. One of the things I think the death of local radio has certainly given us is the fact that there's not enough room for people to cut their teeth. We were talking about the mistakes that I used to make when I was in Portsmouth. There's not enough of that ability now, enough of those vehicles now. I don't know. I think we're in an ever-changing market. We're at the start of a revolution the way we cover football, I think. I think it will change. I think we'll be a lot more interactive. I think it needs to be a lot more interactive. I think we've resisted change a lot. We even got very funny about Sky putting the score bug in the bottom left-hand corner once.
Yeah, but BT Sport do that, don't they?
And we petitioned them and made them change
stopped.
It. And it's like, what?
BT Sport still do it.
So they can run the statistics along the bottom like a ticker.
Yeah.
You know, it's a great idea.
Yeah.
Let them do it. You know, let them get on. I think they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that, you know, you talked about voices. I think camera coverage will change.
Right.
I work with Grant Best, who was the director of programs at BT Sport when it first started. I worked with him in India on a project a couple of years ago, and he has this thing in his mind about how we film football, and it's great, and it's a great idea, but the technology isn't really there yet for us to do.
Is it just more immersive or?
Not necessarily. I don't know whether or not I should share it because I don't know if he's sort of patented it. But
we'll put a pin in that now. We'll talk about it off the air later. You're supposed to bring an insight, Sam. You've got to bring insight to this.
I'll tell you what it is. Most kids now play FIFA, computer games or whatever.
Yeah.
And if you watch FIFA and you watch a football match, there's one particular difference in the way that the camera tracks. So the camera on FIFA will track straight along the line. So you'll follow the ball, but the camera will always be perpendicular to the pitch. So the offside, for example, is always
in line.
In line.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, obviously, in football, we don't do that because we track at an angle.
Yeah. So you're talking about the 100-metre camera that follows the 100-metre runners on a track.
Yeah. Similar sort of thing, yeah.
Okay. And that'll be better.
It'll be better because it will provide you with a better perspective, I think. And it will be more familiar to people who've cut their teeth watching football on computer games rather than actual football. I also think that you'll get more... I think you could do something amazing with highlights packages now with VR cameras and 360 cameras and 180 cameras. I think you could be a bit more creative with the way that you show events.
Was it the League Cup final this season where they, for the first time, they showed what I would call a FIFA-type angle of the penalty shootout? where they had the camera behind the taker.
Yeah.
And for the first sort of 5 or 10 seconds, it was like, wow, this is weird. But it's actually brilliant.
Did you think so? I didn't think it was.
I thought it was brilliant purely because of the information and the insight it gave you. Yeah. When you see a penalty shootout now, the way it's done, it's dramatic because it either goes in or it doesn't. But you don't get an insight as to how it's gone in. You can't see how far wide it's gone, how far over it's gone, how good
see,
a save it was.
Yeah, and I take your point, and I think you're right in some regards, but I also think that the Panenka penalty that Hazard took was completely lost by that angle, because it just looked like it went straight.
Because you couldn't see the flight.
You couldn't see the flight.
Sure, then, okay, so it's horses for courses.
Yeah, so it depends
on what happens.
It depends which one it is to use the best angle, but of course, when in a live scenario, you can't do that. So
no. And you've recently ventured into podcast, and you've got a podcast called All Commentators Are Geeks.
All Football Commentators Are Geeks, yeah.
With fellow commentators, as the name suggests. Podcasting clearly can't solve or improve the live match day experience from a media perspective, but it can offer a lot of other stuff around the game. What made you decide to go into making your podcast?
I wanted to do it. I've always wanted to do a podcast. I think we've spoke about it before.
Yeah.
That I've always wanted to have a podcast, and I'd done one for the Mirror Football for a while, and I really enjoyed doing it, but we couldn't agree a deal in terms of financially. They ran out of money, and they couldn't agree a deal to continue it. So I thought about doing it myself, and I put it together with a few colleagues and friends, and it's a sort of pet project, really. It's a labour of love. I really enjoy it.
But it gives insight to people to find out what commentators are like, what the job entails, all that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a behind the scenes look at the commentary box and what it's like to be in the commentary box, and who we got some great characters in our landscape of football reporting and football commentary and football presenting, and we've been lucky enough to have on our programme talking about their origin stories. Kelly Cates, we've had John Champion, we've had Ian Dark, Darren Fletcher, John Murray from the BBC. The great thing about doing it for myself as well, it's not affiliated to any media company, is that I can get people from Sky, the BBC, from ITV, from everywhere, from BT Sport, everywhere involved in it. And I think if you did it for Talk Sport, or you did it for Sky or someone like that, you'd be hamstrung as to who you could get on. And luckily, we've been very lucky. We've had Jim White, we've had everyone. We haven't had everyone, but we've had a great slice of the commentary and reporting and presentation royalty in this country. We've been very lucky that people have agreed to do it for us.
Well, people should check it out. And before we go, because we're just about out of time, why don't you describe to the listeners what your commentary box looks like? I'm thinking lots of paper, a pen, a cup of Bovril, a packet of Werther's Originals, perhaps some sort of iPad. Is that pretty accurate?
No.
No, okay.
It's a laptop.
Yeah.
And an iPad.
And that's it.
And an Apple Pencil.
Did you do much writing?
Yeah, loads of writing, but with the Apple Pencil. I lose pieces of paper. What's the point?
So you're quite sort of commentator 2.0. I can't imagine Clive Tilsley as an Apple Pencil and a iPad.
Oh, no. I did make him buy an iPad.
Yeah?
Yeah, I forced him into it, I think. Pressure. But he's very much pen and paper. And he has the neatest handwriting in the history of the world.
I bet it can go really small.
Oh, it's really small.
Yeah, and different coloured pens.
He's got one pen, but it's sort of that four-way pen thing.
Oh, I love that.
He does that all the time.
Yeah.
And and everything's got a certain colour. And sometimes I think... he's very, very good at sharing stuff, Clive. So he'll send you his notes or whatever on a game.
That's kind of
very kind. Because it sort of helps you sort of realise what he's done, because he's a very experienced commentator.
Yeah.
So you sort of get a lot of insight from him from that. Yeah. But I can't work out whether or not he's showing off that he's done so much research, or just showing off that he produces basically beautiful art as commentary notes. Because that's what they are.
He could frame that kind of stuff.
No, people do.
People would love that.
I have to show you them one day, because I've got copies of them. I've photocopied them. But they really are. They're like works of art. His commentary notes have been, and John Motson's has as well. He sold his at auctions that have raised stupid amounts of money. I think the one from the 1987 FA Cup final, 87?
What, Keith Houchin?
No, 88 FA Cup final. Okay. Laurie, the Wimbledon one.
Oh, of course, yeah.
The Culture Club.
Yeah, yeah.
And the
Laurie Sanchez.
Yeah, Laurie Sanchez.
Was that 88 or 89? I get confused. 80,
I can't remember. 87 was Houchin's header, wasn't it?
Yeah.
88 was Wimbledon, yeah.
That will work it out, yeah.
So that game, he sold that at a Willow Foundation event, and it got, I think, $20,000 or something.
When I was a kid, I was scared that when I got older, footballers would be replaced by robots, because it would be futuristic and there'd be no players playing anymore. Are you worried about an AI invasion into the commentary box? Google Glass, that kind of stuff, everything Robotronic. You worried about that? Is that going to be something that you need to think about in the next 10, 15 years? Because you're still a relatively Maybe. Young man.
I'm not really. Yeah. I wish I was. I think personality goes a long way.
Yeah.
And one of the things I really get that really gets on my nerves is when we try and curtail personality. I don't think we should be stupid. I don't think we should be silly. I've been told off for it before, and I can be juvenile at times.
Yeah.
But I think you've got to have personality.
Yeah.
And I don't think at the moment computers can replicate that well.
Do you remember that thing that you said about lemon squash?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No, that was orange squash it was.
Orange squash, yeah.
Do you know what? There's a great story about that. And this is, I'm being self-indulgent here.
But people will remember, just remind them what you said.
So I was watching one of the most boring games in the history of Premier League football.
More boring than the Portugal game.
Oh, mate, it was awful. It was Newcastle against Aston Villa.
Yeah.
And it was rubbish. It was so boring. It was nothing happening in the game.
Yeah.
No shots on target. Newcastle won it in the 89th minute with a goal from Loic Remy.
Yeah.
Sort of you forget everything else that happened in between. But there was one moment where Stan had switched off. As sometimes he would sort of like completely, sometimes he would just sort of drift away into nothingness because the game was, was boring. And we'd all switched off. The game had just completely killed us.
People
dead.
Just listening to crowd noise.
Yeah, in fact, I don't actually think if anyone was listening by this point because it was such a bad game. But people were, obviously, because of what happened next. Andreas Weidmann was sent through one-on-one with the goalkeeper and he went charging through. And then when he got to the edge of the penalty area, he hit the ball with all the power of a glass of orange squash made of 52 parts water and one part orange squash. And I actually said that on national radio.
Yeah.
Now,
at the time, did you know?
At the time, you could hear me going through it and my brain was saying, shut up, shut up, stop talking, stop talking, stop talking. And it was only made worse by the fact that when I'd finished that sentence, knowing that I was an absolute idiot, Stan turned around and went, what?
Made it worse.
And then just moved on.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, and it did go viral.
Is it the worst thing you've done? Or are you happy with it? Do you think you've got a sort of affection for it now?
That one I've sort of just embraced, really. Yeah. And I've embraced it because of this. I did Soccer Aid for ITV in 2014 because Clive was unavailable. And that is one of the things that happens to me quite a lot.
Yeah. We've all been there, mate.
I get the gig when Clive's not around.
Yeah.
In fact, at my wedding, someone said, nice for you to be here today. Sorry, Clive couldn't be here instead.
Yeah, great.
Can
I just say, though, take a bit of credit because that's Clive Tilsey. He's a legend of the game.
Yeah.
I get called up when Bob Mills is unavailable. So, listen, we all know how it works. Don't worry about that. We're all in the same cesspit here, mate.
So I was doing Soccer Aid and I had to go to training and there was Ollie Mers was there and whatever. And they said, oh, Robbie Williams is coming out, so you better meet him first of all. And I was like, oh, right, okay.
Yeah.
I'm quite interested.
Had you met him before?
No,
of course. Okay.
And I walked out and the producer said, Robbie, this is our commentator. And Robbie Williams stopped him stone dead. He went, you're Matterface, the orange squash guy, the squash guy from Twitter. And I was like,
yeah.
Yes, that's me. Hi, Robbie.
I've also commented at two Champions League finals, but who cares about that?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, actually, I'm quite surprised that we've gone through this whole interview and you haven't called me Sam Matterface from Dancing on Ice, which is, of course, my new name.
Of course, yeah. So that's a nice little gig as well, isn't it? My wife loves ice dancing, right? So she'll watch. It's the only real reality show she will watch because she watches it. And she'll know you from that. There's nothing wrong with that.
Most people know me from that now.
It's a great gig. It's a great gig.
When
you first told me you were doing that, I didn't watch it. And I thought you meant you were competing.
Ice skating.
And I was like, that's brave. That's brave of you, that.
No, that came about because in an emergency, they really needed someone very quickly.
Hmm.
And, of course, Tony Gubber was the person who did it beforehand.
Sure.
And sadly, passed away. So they were trying to change the way they did it. It didn't quite work. So after a show of the first series back after a break, they rang me up in an emergency. Can you come and do it? I said, I'll do one episode. And then I've just been doing it ever
but
since.
But if you delivered such an Alan Partridge type line on Dancing on Ice, you'd be much more well known.
I'm sure I have.
Oh, okay.
I'm sure I've done worse gags than that on Dancing on Ice. I mean, that is just a cheese fest.
And what people need to understand, though, and I don't think this gets talked about enough, and not that could be chiefly because no one cares. But when you broadcast so many hours a week, you're obviously going to have something like that's going to happen. And it feels like as soon as you do that, some people leap on you, right? They leap on you. They don't think about all the other stuff you do.
I don't care, really. I think it's, I enjoy it. I think it's fun. You know, we're having a bit of a laugh. We're not, at the end of the day, it's not serious, is it? I mean, dancing on ice and football, that's my bread and butter. I don't think
no,
I'm...
No, it's not the end of the world, is it?
I'm not really worried about the peace treaty between North Korea and the US administration. So,
but maybe in the future you might be.
Hey, you know.
It's like that old Steve Coogan sketch where he's a pool attendant. In 1985, no one died. In 1986, no one died. In 1987, someone died. Have us to the best of us. Sam, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you very much
for your time.
Thanks for having me.
People listening should take into account all football commentators are geeks and go and give that a listen.
At AFC Geeks on Twitter.
There we go, because it's a great listen to people, for anyone really who's interested in the world of football broadcasting. Thank you very much, Sam. It's been great. And I'll catch up with you again soon. This episode of Ramble Meets was sponsored by Bet365.
This was a Radio Staccato production.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces 3 thought-provoking questions over 3 glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.